Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 185, I chat with Steve Guttenberg about the differences between audio systems for music and movies. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded December 2nd, 2013, episode 185, Stereo versus Surround. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting is a mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting. Pay for what you use. It doesn't require a contract and offers unlimited devices on one account. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit htg.ting.com. That's htg.ting.com. And by Tonks Coffee. Tonks offers a bi-weekly subscription. Tonks sources their beans directly from the growers. They're roasted and shipped within 24 hours, giving you the freshest coffee beans in the world. For a free sample, visit tonks.org/HTG. That's tonks.org/HTG. And by Hulu Plus. Hulu Plus lets you binge on thousands of hit shows anytime, anywhere on your TV, PC, smartphone, or tablet. Visit HuluPlus.com/HTG to start your free 2-week trial. That's HuluPlus.com/HTG. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and director of content at avsforum.com. This week's guest geek is Steve Guttenberg, noted audio reviewer for CNET and other outlets, and the author of the Audiophiliac blog on CNET, coming back to join us on the show. Hey, Steve, welcome back.
Hey, I'm glad to be back. I think this is my third appearance.
I believe it is your third appearance. Absolutely. Yeah. And certainly not your last, if I have anything to say about it.
We'll see about that. Yeah. Okay.
We shall see.
Hope I pass the audition.
Oh, well, by this time, I'm sure you have, without doubt.
Okay.
Now, those of you who are watching live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv, can post questions for Steve as we go along, and I'll pass along as many as I can. And I imagine there might be some questions this week, because we are going to be talking about the difference between music reproduction and movie reproduction, and we're going to throw TV in there as well, and how that affects the sound system and what you need to think about in terms of optimizing the sound system for each of those tasks. And it turns out, Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, that optimizing the system for those two things, playing back music, playing back movies, are two pretty different things when it comes to audio, right?
Absolutely. I mean, dynamic range is the first thing that I think about, but also that music is almost always stereo, has been for more than 50 years. Mm-hmm. Not counting the little side trips into SACD and DVD audio and Blu-ray, but that's 1% of all music that's available. I would be shocked if it was even 1%. Mm-hmm. So stereo is the name of the game. And for movies, for the last 20, 25 years, it's been multi-channel pretty much exclusively, at least for major movies. Then we also have the addition of subwoofers and LFE for movies, where there's no real equivalent for music.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, it's also a side thing of how music is made and recorded and mixed versus movies, where basically in movies, again, over the last 10 or 20 years, that movies are essentially complete fabrications of their soundtrack. There's not a lot of reality in movie sound. It's all done in post-production. Even the dialogue is usually replaced depending on the kind of movie that it is. So
right.
There's not a lot of there. It's all Hollywood magic and so.
Whereas music is as it was performed. Now, in many cases, there's overdubbing, it's not an entire performance live all at the same time. Although there are some people who are doing that.
Yeah, it depends on the kind of music. On classical, it's more likely to be in jazz. It's more likely to be the whole group, the whole band, the whole orchestra playing together, that sort of thing. But again, so they're very, very different things. Now, I think that one of the things that's sort of interesting about it is that I think you have to introduce into this story the whole idea of how people experience these things and to the degree that they're going to be multitasking when they're listening to music versus watching a movie. And I think that makes all the difference. You know, it's really interesting that movies have the other big difference between movies and music is movies have extreme dynamic range between the softest, quietest parts of a movie and the loudest explosions or excuse me, or special effects. So that's gigantic. And most music is highly compressed. Again, with rare exceptions, but when we
see you mean when it's recorded,
well, when it's
mastered, when it's finalized,
yeah, it tends to be highly compressed. I was saying to you before we started on the air here that I worked for an audiophile label called Chesky Records for about 10 or 12 years, and Chesky Records have little or no compression. And over the years, many of my audiophile friends would complain to me. They'd say, you know, Steve, I like Chesky's records, but they're too low. They're too quiet in level. And I would say, yes, that's because they're not compressed, meaning the quiet parts or the more moderate parts are where the level is most of the time. And then occasionally it gets loud compared to most music where it's loud or at a very consistently loud level in the mix most of the time.
Right. So, the difference between the softest and the loudest parts in most music, certainly most pop music, what you hear on the radio, at least, is very narrow. The difference between the loudest and the softest parts.
It could be 3 or 4 dB, you know,
not very much.
Right. And in a movie, it could be 20, 25 dB. So these are gigantic differences. And people might notice that if you were playing a movie in your home theater and then at whatever comfortable level that you were watching that movie, if you just took out that disc and put in a fairly recently recording and didn't change the volume setting, it would be way too loud because the music is at its loudest point most of the time. And a movie, depending on the kind of movie, has quieter parts and louder parts. It's not loud consistently.
Right.
So it's interesting that the people who make music seem to be unaware that people already have at home, if they watch movies at home over a home theater at least, they already are experiencing sound with extremely wide dynamic range. And yet now, over the last 10 years especially, we've experienced this thing called the loudness wars, which means that music has gotten louder and louder, meaning more and more compressed so that it's loud most of the time. Mm. And that these two things are occurring at the same time. Wide dynamic range movies and heavily, heavily compressed music, which is sometimes played over the same system. That strikes me as completely bizarre.
Yeah, yeah. Now, why do you suppose that is? I mean, they're serving two different masters in some sense.
Right.
I mean,
well, we
certainly the compression over the radio, I could sort of understand. I mean, if you're in your car, you've got a high noise floor to deal with.
That's part of it, but we get back to the multitasking thing. In a movie theater, to take that as the ideal setting to watch a movie at least, the chances of people multitasking, well, nowadays I'm sure many people could be multitasking, but probably for the bulk of the audience, they're watching the movie. They're not texting. They're not talking. Hopefully they're not talking. They're not checking their stock prices or anything. They're watching the movie. And when you're watching the movie and you're involved in the movie, you can tolerate, to use, I can't think of a better way of saying it, you can tolerate wide dynamic range because you're in it. You're inside the story, hopefully.
You're paying a lot of attention.
And you're paying a lot of attention. Where at home, you're less likely to be 100% focused on it. And nowadays, with getting back to music, most people, I think if you suggest to them, do you ever listen to music and not do anything else? Just close your eyes and listen. Not read, not talk, not wash the floor. Just listen. I think most people would find that a kind of a bizarre question. Like, why? I don't understand. I read, I talk, I'm cooking, I'm cleaning my house or something as I listen to music. But actually just focusing and listening is the least likely scenario. And because that is the case, that's why it needs to be heavily compressed, because it needs to be audible as all these other things in your life are happening. If the quiet parts are much quieter, you'd say, oh, it's too low and I got to turn it up, and then suddenly it gets too loud. So then that sort of explains why this need for compression in music.
Yeah.
And in the car, it's a similar thing. You're in a very noisy environment. If there were quiet parts, you wouldn't hear the quieter parts. You need to have it above the noise level, comfortably above the noise level all the time.
Right.
So we get, that explains it.
Yeah, that does explain it. Taylor Karras in the chat room is saying, I will admit that the compression does bring out the small details, which may be true, especially if you're not sitting there paying close attention, which I've always thought was the definition of an audiophile. You know, that an audiophile is someone who sits down and listens to a symphony, you know, as if they were at a concert.
Right, Well, when you talk about the not hearing the quieter parts, well, that's the details, because that's because it's dropping below the noise level of your environment, meaning your car, out in the street, on the park, on the beach, or wherever you are when you're listening to music. If you were in a super quiet room, quieter than any room probably in New York City, you would hear all that stuff to use it in some sort of context, naturally, as if you were actually hearing live music. But when you're hearing it in noisier and noisier places, you need to compress it to keep that the quieter parts above the noise level of your environment.
Mm-hmm.
Hence the need for compression.
Hence the need. Beatmaster in the chat room is saying there's compression and then there's sinful compression.
Matter of fact, you know what's amazing? 2 years ago, I was at an Audio Engineering Society convention in New York City, and they always have panels on compression. But that one 2 years ago, they actually had one about how far it's gotten. That at that one, they were talking about where they were intentionally overs, what's called overs, where it's louder than 0 dB, meaning it's just 100% distortion. But it's for fractions of a second. It's not consistently over 0 dB. So there were all these recordings that had these overs, which used to be called mistakes if you go over 0 dB, the digital recording. But now it's done on purpose to give it that crispy, as an effect, to give it that extra crunchy, crispy sound that people love so much in modern recordings. So in other words, they're adding distortion. They're doing two things. They're adding intentional distortion, which Jimi Hendrix was doing in 1967, but they're doing it as an effect, and also to keep it loud, even louder, more of the time. That's pretty bizarre. Just when you thought it couldn't get louder, they figured out a way to make it
louder. Yeah, Beatmaster is mentioning an example of a group called Snow Patrol. I don't know that artist. Do you?
No.
Beatmaster saying it's a terrible example of dynamic range, or rather the lack thereof. So we're just talking about.
By the way, for your listeners and readers and watchers, there's this interesting website. It's called DR Database, Dynamic Range Database. And they have listings of many, many thousands of albums of their dynamic range, taking the quietest track on it. Now, there you go. The quietest track on the album, the average level, and they break it down not just for the album, but whether it's a CD or whether it's an LP. And it's interesting that most LPs, not always, but many, have much wider dynamic range than digital media does, which is, when you think about it, kind of weird, because LPs have less dynamic range than digital media does. So it's kind of funny how it worked out. But I guess it's predicated on the idea that, guess what? When you're listening to a record, you're probably home.
Hey, you're not listening to the record in the car, that's for sure.
Yeah, you're not on the beach probably listening to records. I mean,
you don't want your stone sand to get in the stylus.
So again, that sort of follows my idea here of where you're listening, and the increasing chance, or the less likely, that you'd be multitasking as you're listening. To get back to this LP thing, it's really interesting that 6 months ago I did a blog and I interviewed 6 or 7 people under 40 years old who had just gotten a turntable in the last year. And they all said the same thing, that they noticed, excuse me, that when they played records, they didn't multitask. And I thought that was an amazing thing, that 100% of the seven people that I talked to, that they all said that same thing. Even, one of them was 14 years old, and he said, I just think, you know, when I play music on my phone, it's a different thing. I'm jumping around from tune to tune and stuff. But when I'm playing a record, I get up, I put the record on the turntable, put the stylus in the group, and I listen to the record.
Now, these were young people you were talking to?
Yeah, they were all young. Well, from 14 to 40 years old.
Okay, well, that counts as young to me.
Yeah, you know. But I wanted people who had just gotten into it. I didn't want to talk to old people, people our age, and ask them about records because they have their own associations and stuff. I wanted people it was fresh to them and what they were, you know, experiencing.
Well,
and
am I correct?
They all said similar things.
This leads to a question that I've had and thing I've thought about sometimes is, am I correct that the popularity of vinyl records, of LPs, has in fact started to increase with the younger listeners? And it's not only because they can be used for scratching and hip-hop stuff, right? I mean, they're actually listening to this music on the records?
Well, you know, here is the most amazing thing. Up until 10 years ago, most of the vinyl that people were, you know, new vinyl that was being bought was by audiophiles, and it was reissues of Kind of Blue and the Allman Brothers at the Fillmore East. But nowadays, there's most young, you know, hip young bands put out vinyl of their new record. Absolutely. Hmm. And here is one of the most incredible things that I'm not saying this to hype up what I'm about to say. It's true. I would never have believed that in 2013, a new record store, a new major record store would open in New York City selling vinyl and CDs only.
Wow. Tower went away. All these record stores went away.
The stores are gone. And Rough Trade, this British company, opened a 15,000 square foot record store in Brooklyn, which I went to just the other day, and it was amazing. I would say it's 50% LPs, 50% CDs, and all the vinyl that I saw there, I don't think I was seeing Kind of Blue or, you know, Sketches of Spain. I was seeing music by new artists. So, as Dylan said, something's going on because it is definitely changing. So
wow, well that's quite remarkable.
That's really encouraging. I mean, I still think it's incredible that it's not like a little neighborhood thing. This is a, I wouldn't say giant, but it's a substantially sized store. It's
in one of the biggest cities in the world.
Yeah. And I was talking to the manager while I was there, and I said, I'm just shocked that you did this. And he said, well, the reason we did it is because 7 years ago in London we did the same thing, and it's still going strong. So even though people who love music today have the option of not paying for it, of getting music for free, well, they've had a store in London, which is a pretty expensive city to do business in. They have a store where people have to go and buy records and CDs to hear the music. And they're not, it's not a discount place. They're pretty much sold at full price.
Full pop.
So they pulled it off in London, and now they're going to see if they can do it in New York City. So
I wish him luck because I used to love going to the record store, Tower in particular, and, you know, rifling through the CDs at that time and, you know, finding stuff that was cool.
Yeah. So things are changing in unexpected ways, which is fantastic, actually. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So well, listen, before back to the subject. Sorry. Oh, you want to do your thing?
Before we get back to the subject at hand, the primary subject at hand, I would like to thank one of our sponsors for this episode, which is Ting. Now, Ting is a no BS mobile service, a reseller of the Sprint network. So, you know, you're getting a really good coverage, really great service from Ting. But Ting is somehow different. How is that? Well, no contracts for one thing, no early termination fees for another. It's just straight ahead, pay as you go, and as I will explain. They even have an early termination fee, ETF, relief program. Now, this is cool. Dig this. If you're paying an ETF to come to Ting, they've got your back. They'll give you a credit of 25% of your ETF up to $75 per device. Simply purchase your device through Ting, port your number over, and then submit your final bill with your ETF detailed from your previous carrier. Go to ting.com/ETF for more information. Now, when I said pay-as-you-go, I really meant it. There are no overage charges or penalties, no bundling or ride-along services, no add-on charges. You get voicemail, caller ID, tethering, hotspot, three-way calling, call forwarding, and other features. They're all part of the service. Nothing is added on. There's no mysterious line items on your bill. And you can have unlimited devices on one plan. Each device only costs $6 a month. Now, there's a powerful online account control panel that lets you take control of your account, your usage and bills. There's also, and this is really important, no hold customer support. You call them at 855-TING-FTW anytime between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern time, and a real person will pick up the phone. Now, how often does that happen, really? Not often enough. They also have excellent online support at help.ting.com. So what you do is you purchase your mobile device from Ting, which you'll receive in 2 to 5 business days. Then you activate your device with Ting, and you have the option to select a new phone number or port over an existing one. Ting will break out your rates in minutes, text messages, and megabytes, and bill you at the end of each month exactly for what you used. So visit Ting today at htg.ting.com. Save money and better manage your mobile phone usage with Ting. Now, Home Theater Geeks viewers can also save $25 on your first Ting device when you sign up. So visit htg.ting.com and start saving today. And we thank Ting very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire TWIT network. So, Steve Guttenberg, let's get back to the subject at hand here, which is the audio system that you put in your home and whether or not it's going to be used for music or movies. Are you telling us that you sort of have to make that decision ahead of time when you're planning your audio system?
Well, you should be thinking about which way to skew it. You know, are you going to be watching movies a few hours a week and then most of the time listening to music? Or is it going to be the other way around, where you rarely listen to music at home and you mostly watch movies? I think that would tilt the direction of the system, the ideal system, one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. You know, you can't have both in one system. You can't have both served ideally with one system. Is that what you're saying?
If you throw enough money at it, you can.
All right.
Enough money, you can accomplish anything, but.
Yeah, I suppose.
You know, I think with music, I think the priority, if you're an audiophile, at least, if you're an audiophile, you would want the most transparent, well-balanced, in other words, tonally balanced system you possibly could. And you'd be willing, and you want stereo imaging, if that's what's important to you, it is to me. You'd want those things, that you might prioritize those things. With home theater, you're more likely to prioritize, will it play loud enough, if you're lucky enough to live in a place where you can play things as loud as you want? Is mm-hmm. the bass response, you know, deep enough and powerful enough for the kind of movies that you watch? Is the multi-channel part of it working for you in the best way possible? You know, so those are different, wildly different requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, there's a middle ground where you could do, I've gotten in trouble for this over the years, you could do a stereo home theater with just two channels.
Ooh.
I have a stereo home theater at home with an Oppo BDP95 Blu-ray player, mm-hmm. excuse me, a pair of MagnaPan 3.7 speakers, pass electronics, and a big Panasonic plasma TV. And that, I think the sense of envelopment and spaciousness coming out of those speakers is amazing. Now, I listen to music probably 9 hours or 10 hours for every 1 hour I would watch a movie. It's mostly a music-oriented system. But mm-hmm. it does movies, at least the kind of movies that I watch, extremely well. So
what kind of movies do you watch? Let's trying to define that.
I'd be less likely to watch, you know, special effects oriented movies, more straight dramas kind of thing, you know, so.
Right. Where the surround sound probably isn't as important.
Right. Now, occasionally I watch some of those in the context of writing reviews about stuff, and I'm always amazed how much of that actually comes through stereo speakers, that kind of depth and spaciousness of surround sound. It's not the same thing, but it you know when it's there, because essentially a stereo fold-down mix of a multi-channel mix still has all the information that's in all five or seven channels just put into two. And a lot of times they'll take that, the surround stuff, and play with the phase of it. So it's not strictly stereo anymore. It's coming out of two speakers, but there's an amazing degree of spaciousness to it.
Mm.
So it's not like all is lost by doing it. But sure, if you watch most and you're interested in special effects driven movies, you should definitely have a multi-channel home theater. No doubt about it.
Right.
We were talking about
music being mostly two-channel, and Sound Pro 69 in the chat room is saying, I don't see why music enjoyment has to be limited to two-channel. Even with good simulated surround and a well-calibrated system, you can enjoy orchestral music much more than on two-channel. Would you agree?
No.
You know, that's fine.
The thing is, I have to tell you a funny story about surround sound. So my friend Brent Butterworth, who I think you've had on this show, right?
I have had on the show, and he'll be on again, I'm sure.
Okay. So for a year or two, he was working for Dolby, and they had a demo at a CES show, and it was in one of those like a fabricated room. So it wasn't on the main floor, but it was this room. You go inside, there's like a living room and a couch and, you know, a system and stuff. So I know Brent a long time. I wouldn't have done this with a stranger, but he said, oh, what movie do you want to see? I want to show you this new Dolby surround we're doing. And I said, you know, we talked about a movie. He turns his back to me. He's loading the disc into the player, and there's a couch. And I lay down on the couch. And he turns around. He says, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm kind of tired. I'm kind of beat from this CES show. Start your movie. And he said, well, I don't think that's a great idea, because your head is about 3 inches away from the right surround speaker, and your feet are, you know, a foot away from the left surround speaker, so you're not going to hear it. I said, hey, Brent, this is the way real people watch movies. Mm. They're not seated bolt upright in the sweet spot. Start your movie. So he starts the movie, and I said, God, the surrounds are so loud. He says, yeah, because your head's a foot away from the speaker. I said, sorry, that's the way real people do it. So that's a little anecdote about my opinion. So with movies, the sound is always anchored to the center channel in the front, and most of the action is in the front. And depending on the kind of movie it is, the kind of mix it is, the action is front-oriented. But when it comes to multi-channel music discs without video, to sort of anchor the positions of things, you really have to be in the sweet spot to make the mix work. When you move off of the sweet spot and you get too close to one of the surround speakers or something, it kind of falls apart. The falseness of the mix just becomes, well, that's maybe too strong a word, but the mix only really works in that sweet spot position where, you know, in the perfect world, you'd be equidistant from all the speakers in the system.
Mm-hmm.
So multi-channel, I spent many years reviewing multi-channel audio recordings. Most people that make and mix multi-channel recordings don't get it. They make bizarre choices as to where things are in the thing. They're not trying to make a natural sound. Every now and then someone gets it. Steven Wilson of this band, Porcupine Tree, has made some of the best multi-channel audio mixes for his band, and he's done remasters of Yes and King Crimson and stuff. He's done a lot of great recordings, and he's one of the few people out there that really understand how to create a surround mix that works and isn't super restrictive in terms of where you sit relative to the speakers to make the mix work.
Mm.
And actually, I asked him, I interviewed him about this once, and I said, how is it that you get it and very few people do? And he said that the first Porcupine record Tree that came out in multi-channel, he hated it. He took it home. He was expecting it to have this certain sound. He didn't have it. And he vowed that after that, even though he didn't know anything about mixing surround sound, he thought he could do a better job than the people who supposedly did know. So he really approached mixing multi-channel with a clean sheet of paper. He didn't have any preconceptions as to what it should be or what it shouldn't be. He just made something that sounded good. And whatever it is, he's got the knack, and he's one of the few that got it right. But most don't. And my experience, and I've heard many, many, many surround mixes over the years, most just don't. They just sort of random. Oh, put the guitar over there and the piano over there. It's just sort of, it doesn't relate to anything. At least stereo, the rules of the game for mixing stereo, where things appear and how you use it, is sort of, people sort of got that. They figured it out. You know, in the early days of stereo, they put the vocal in the left channel and the drums and the guitar on the right channel. That didn't last very long. We pretty quickly figured out how a stereo picture should work. And people can play with it and experiment with it, but the basic ideas of what stereo is are locked down. But in the early days, meaning in the early 2000s of multi-channel music, I went to many an AES meeting, an Audio Engineering Society meeting, where there were these discussions about what do we do with surround sound for music? And there was never any consensus, like, is the vocal hard in the center speaker? Most multi-channel recordings don't. They put the vocal equally in left and right and almost nothing in the center, which I think is kind of weird because that's what the center is for.
That's what the center is for.
Right. But they're not used to it. It makes them nervous to put the vocal hard in the center.
Hardwired to think that that's dialogue coming out of that center channel.
It's a center channel. It's a dialogue speaker. But anyway, yes, in a perfect world, I could see great things happening with surround sound for music. But the problem is that people, like my analogy about laying down on the couch, it won't. If you made a really great surround mix, most of the time it's not going to work unless you're really in that sweet spot. And that's not the way real people listen to music. So it's got a long ways to go. And it hasn't happened really, other than Steven Wilson. Is he the only genius that can figure out how to do it? Well, for right now, apparently he is, because I haven't heard too many others.
Heard the surround mixes from Mark Waldrop at AIX Records? I think he does a pretty good job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. You're not so convinced.
They sound good, but I don't think his surround mixes. He has that thing, the audience mix.
Audience and perspective stage. And then the stage perspective where you're in the middle of the group.
Yeah. Unless you're a musician, that doesn't actually make sense.
Well, and I'm, as a musician myself, I happen to like those stage mixes, but I recognize that I'm unusual in that respect. Most people would rather, I'm sure, feel like they're in the audience and the music is in front of them being performed, maybe in the surround, some ambience from the hall, which he also offers you.
Is that the idea that this whole thing happened with multi-channel music struck me as kind of bizarre, because people could have always played stereo recordings over their surround system in, Dolby Pro Logic or DTS Neo 6. So if that's what you want to do, is have the band in the front and have ambience in the rear, a push of the button will get you there with any stereo, pretty much any stereo recording. So we don't need multi-channel recordings to do that.
To do that. Yeah, that's a good point. And in fact, you've answered in the last few minutes the question from Swamp Rat in the chat room. In which he asks if you have any opinions about albums being re-released on Blu-ray. Now, in most of those cases, already you're getting a multi-channel re-release. Are you not? I mean, the Yes album certainly are being remixed in 5.1.
Yeah. Again, they can be good, I remember when Pete Townsend did Tommy in 5.1 on SACD and DVD audio more or less simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And I just found it bizarre. It just seemed kind of random. When Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads took all the Talking Heads studio albums and remixed them to 5.1 for DVD audio probably 10 years ago, he did an amazing job. And I talked to him about it. I did a story for Home Theater Magazine, and he said that he basically put a year's work into remixing these records into 5.1. And what he did so well is he took the stereo mix and made it bigger, So it created sort of this U-shape stereo where it was the same thing as the stereo, but bigger. And because it was spread out over more speakers, you actually heard more things that were sort of crowded into the stereo mix that were now opened up in this 5.1 mix. And I thought, well, there you go. I mean, it can be done. It just takes intelligence. It takes someone who really knows what they're doing, is really into the music, and knows what he needs to bring out of the music. Mm. But again, unfortunately, that's the least likely scenario in the real world.
Mm.
And I said to Stephen Wilson, who's such a big believer in 5.1, I said, can you conceive literally of making a new recording where you think of it that way? It's not like an after effect that you apply it to something that was originally conceived as a stereo mix, where you're writing this music and composing this music and creating this music, thinking of it as 5.1. Now, that to me would be really exciting, but to take something and disassembling what was once stereo and making it to 5.1, it can work, but it's less likely to.
Now, did Steve Wilson talk about that possibility of actually creating music for 5.1 from the beginning?
Yeah, he's done two albums that way, and they're both really, really good. I wish I could remember their names, but the Stephen Wilson fans out there know what they are, and I recommend them. Oh, Grace for Drowning is the one that I know best, and then there was one after that called, I think it's The Raven. But Grace for Drowning is a terrific recording, and it also has real dynamic range, you know, because
he's not one who compresses the heck out of it, huh?
Well, again, because you're going to be more likely to be home to listen to this multi-channel thing on Blu-ray. You're not in your car. You're not on the beach. So the conditions are right to hear something with wide dynamic range.
Right, right. Well, before we get back to this very fascinating discussion, I'd like to thank another of our sponsors for this episode, which is Tonks Coffee. Now, Tonks is a small company made up of a tight-knit group of experts who believe that everybody deserves a great cup of coffee, and everyone can brew that great cup right in their own kitchen. That is, if you have the right beans. And this is really where all good coffee starts, isn't it? Tonks sources their beans directly from the growers, roasts them, and ships them within 24 hours of that roasting for the freshest beans you can find. Like I said, they ship them within 24 hours, so you're getting super fresh coffee, much fresher than you're going to find in any other kind of retail environment. And they are convinced that home-brewed coffee can be just as good as your favorite cafe. Now, how much do you spend for coffee every morning at your local cafe where you might get your coffee? It's not as hard to do at home as those baristas make it out to be. And this is really important, as long as you start with fresh beans, which you can't get if you buy beans in the grocery store. And pre-ground coffees are even worse. So you really need to start with those fresh beans, grind them yourself. And Tonks makes that very easy and very convenient, because it's a bi-weekly subscription that you simply tell them that you're interested in this subscription, and they'll send you a bag of beans every other week right to your door, just for the price of a few of those cafe visits. So if you're hitting the cafe most mornings, this is a much more economical and a much better way to get that great cup of coffee that you crave every morning. And they offer plenty of help also on equipment and brewing methods, all kinds of different information there on their website, which I do hope you will go check out. In fact, that is Tonks, tonx.org/HTG, which is where we would love for you to go and pick up a free sample. All you have to do is let them know you want to try it out, and they will send some to you so that you can convince yourself, as I'm sure you will, that getting Tonks coffee, getting your coffee, your morning coffee this way, is really the best way to do it. And every 2 weeks, a new batch shows up at your door. It's subscription only, and as I said, offering a free sample to our listeners. So visit tonks.org/HTG. And we thank Tonks Coffee very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire TWIT network. So we've been talking about two-channel versus multi-channel music, the difference between music and movies, primarily being in terms of dynamic range. Now, I wanted to ask you one question, Steve, about a music system versus a movie system. Movie systems, we know, need a subwoofer. Do you recommend ever, is there any circumstance under which you would recommend having a subwoofer in a music system?
Sure. I mean, if you listen to music that has, you know, a lot of very deep bass content, you know, getting really deep bass under, let's define that as under 50 hertz or under 40 hertz bass, well, getting that out of even full range speakers, it's not such a simple thing to do. Because even if you had really big speakers with large woofers and stuff, you're going to put those speakers where they sound best for stereo. The beauty of adding a subwoofer, even to a system with large speakers, is that you can put the subwoofer where it works for bass.
Mm-hmm.
So for many years, I used had these JM Labs Mini Utopias, which were sort of a large bookshelf speaker, and I had a REL subwoofer. But I had the REL sub placed for deep bass, so I could have great imaging from my speakers and very, very deep bass from this subwoofer. So, yeah, absolutely. I think if you listen to that sort of music where very deep bass is important, if you listen to organ recordings, maybe tubas, know, having a good sub really makes a difference, because it's a more visceral, and on really good recordings, classical recordings especially, you hear more of the room itself when you have a system with true, you know, very low frequency bandwidth, which doesn't happen over full range speakers.
Except if you spend a whole heck of a lot of money.
But even if you do I remember when I worked at Sound by Singer and we had Wilson Whams, which are $85,000 speakers with 15-inch woofers. Eventually, Wilson came out with a subwoofer, and it was a Krell subwoofer that we used first. We had this Krell sub, and it was amazing how even with $85,000 speakers with gigantic woofers, it's not the same thing as having a subwoofer placed properly in a room, and how much more you're going to get.
Well, I have often said this, that the best placement for your main speakers is not necessarily or even usually the best place for the low frequencies to be coming
from,
which is why you need a subwoofer, because you can place that separately than you can your main speakers.
Right. That's the nitty gritty. And that's, as they used to say, you can't argue with Mother Nature. Someone has that used to say it, but yeah. No fooling with Mother Nature. But
no fooling Mother Nature. I think, I think it was a margarine company, but same idea there. Yes.
So yes, I do believe in subwoofers for music, but that's if you listen to the kind of music where that's important, you know, which could be, you know, classical, it could be organ recordings, it could be dance music, you know, where you need like
a really deep bass.
Yeah. So there's a lot of types of music where we're adding a subwoofer to even a system based around large speakers would be good. And again, if you're going to do a stereo home theater and you're watching movies that have lots of low frequency energy, again, adding the sub is possible. And by the way, you can do it with any stereo preamplifier. You don't need a preamplifier. You don't need a processor that has dedicated subwoofer outputs. The only thing that subwoofer outputs get you, hopefully, is bass management. But with large speakers, you don't need bass management. You can run speaker level off of the main amp that's driving the speakers and run a speaker wire to the subwoofer. And most subs have speaker level inputs, which create basically no extra load on the stereo amplifier that's driving the speakers, and get the subwoofer to run off of that amplifier.
And that and the subwoofer works. Itself has the crossover.
The low-pass crossover and its own amplification that's driving the sub, and it works very, very well. So it's doable. It's not even complicated. So you can have a purist two-channel high-end audio system and still run a sub. And everybody wins for music, for movies. It all comes together. It's not a complicated, hard thing to pull off.
Now, let me ask you this with regard to that system you just specified. You have a pair of even full range speakers and a subwoofer, and you're driving the subwoofer from the speaker level outputs from the amplifier. Mm-hmm. Doesn't that mean that the full range drivers are going to be reproducing full range speakers? I mean, are going to be reproducing some of the same frequencies as the subwoofer? Yeah.
Well, no, that's where the low pass and the subwoofer comes in. So let's say the speakers are starting to roll off at a very large speaker. So they're starting to roll off around 40 hertz. Mm-hmm. So you're going to turn that low pass basically at 40 hertz. You obviously have to experiment. It's always, there's room gain, there's many issues involved, but you'd be running the sub very, very low. In other words,
Now I understand. Okay, so you're taking the signal from... They're not competing. You're getting the
full range signal from the sub, from the amplifier that's driving the speakers. That's getting full, sending full range signal to the sub, and then to the subwoofer.
Yeah,
it's getting the same signal as the speakers, but then it's rolling off everything. Let's just overly simplify over 40 hertz. So the sub is only reproducing under 40 hertz.
Right,
so it's
the speakers aren't getting anything up lower than 40 hertz.
Oh, they're getting it, but they're just not reproducing it. Because they can't, because they're in the wrong part of the room.
Drivers aren't
big enough, whatever. So the sub is just sort of, think of it, is it coming in literally underneath whatever the speakers are capable of.
Got it. SoundPro 69 is asking, or is making a comment, I use omnidirectional speakers, which allow for a lot more flexibility of position to enjoy surround, he says. But what's your feeling on omnidirectional speakers in general?
I like them, actually. I think if your room can deal with, because placing omnidirectional speakers, meaning the sound is radiating at 360 degrees or close to 360 degrees, so it's interacting more with the room, so you need to have cooperative room acoustics to make it work. But Mirage, which I'm not sure if the company still exists in Canada, had a whole line of really wonderful little omnidirectional speakers. Omnipolar speakers, they called them, and they were terrific. It's a different sound than a direct radiating speaker. It's less focused. It's more spacious sounding. Using them for surround speakers, you know, makes sense. But you could do a omnidirectional 5.1 system with those speakers. So I do like omnidirectional speakers.
Midnight classic, Rider asks.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
But you know, classic dipole. And bipole surround speakers, you know, those V-shaped cabinets that were just surround speakers where they had with drivers, you know, aimed forward, aimed back.
Forward
they
and backward,
kind of did their own sort of, I wouldn't say omnidirectional, but this kind of spacious, non-localizable sound sources as opposed to a regular direct radiating speaker where it is local. Mm. You can localize the source.
Right. Do omnidirectional speakers give you less... imaging specificity, shall we say?
Yes,
you were talking about that earlier, about with a stereo pair, it's well known by mixers where the instruments are placed. And if the speakers can reproduce that, then you can hear where each instrument is in space in front of you. And omnidirectional speakers, I would think,
it's more diffuse. It's just softer.
Yeah.
But, you know, some people might say, Dr. M.R. Bose used to say, that, you know, in real life, it's not pinpoint focused, you know, and if you go to a concert hall and listen to 300 tubas, you wouldn't hear them precisely focused. You'd hear many reflections before that sound got to you. So it would be kind of diffuse. So in that sense, omnidirectional speakers are closer to that sound. So it's, you know, that's the thing that's so fascinating about audio, is that it's always working on many, many levels. You know, you can come at thing, you know, these problems from different directions, and there's no one answer. It's a matter of, you know, trying different things and seeing what works for you.
Mm-hmm. Midnight Rider in the chat room is asking if you use a sub with your Maggies.
Actually, I don't. Because I tend not to listen to music that requires it.
That really requires it.
How low do those Maggies go? Very low. These are big 6 foot tall Maggies with a lot of bass capability. They go down to around 40, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about MagnaPlaner bass is MagnaPlaner... I can't even speak now. MagnaPlaner bass sound has a different quality than a bass coming off of a 12-inch woofer, where a 12-inch woofer, subwoofer, or speaker has a more punchy, you know, aggressive sound if the music requires it. And MagnaPans soften that. They don't have that kind of attack that a dynamic speaker does. It can't suddenly, like a thump of a kick drum, it can't do that as well as a subwoofer can. It can go down in frequency, it just doesn't have that impact of a good subwoofer.
So
MagnaPans,
just so that everybody understands, are what are called planar magnetic speakers. They don't have a cone or a dome or several different drivers like traditional or conventional speakers have. It's a big flat sheet of material that vibrates.
Right. It's a very interesting idea, actually, because the company is, there you go. The company is based in Minnesota, and they've been making these speakers since the late 60s or early 70s. They start at $600 a pair. They're made entirely in the United States, and they're just a very, as high-end companies go, a very down-to-earth company. They don't charge crazy money for the for their products. And basically what a magnetoplaner is it's not to be confused with an electrostatic speaker. Many people think of it as being similar when it's not. The only thing that electrostatics and magnetoplaners have in common is that they're flat panel speakers. But electrostatic speakers need to be plugged into a wall that charges a grid, and then that grid gets a signal and pulls the diaphragm towards it or repels it from the grid. A magnetoplaner does not get plugged into a wall. It's essentially, it's like if you took the voice coil of a woofer and unwound the voice coil and then distributed it over the entire panel in, let's say, a vertical up and down motion, and then had magnets, bar magnets behind those things. So it's basically like bar magnets, I'm sorry, putting the full height of the speaker. So it's essentially just like a cone woofer, but it's distributed over the entire area, where it's a cone or a dome is the coil pushing from the center of the driver, and then the rest of the driver is just sort of flopping around, and hopefully not too much, to create the sound. In a magnetoplane, the entire diaphragm is under control of the magnets.
I know
the whole area of the driver is voice coil. It's a distributed voice coil.
Right, right. And it's a relatively large area.
Right, it's a membrane. Very large area. Yeah, so it has to move back and forth, unlike a woofer. You can see them moving back and forth. A magnetoplane is moving hundredths of an inch. It barely has to move because the radiating area is so gigantic.
Right. Now, the electrostatic speakers, Martin Logan is probably the most well-known exponent of that. They include conventional woofer drivers in many of their speakers in the base. To handle the low frequencies, which the electrostatics can't really do. What about the magnapans? Do they encompass the entire frequency spectrum?
They do, actually. They're more purist in that sense, that they the woofer is it can make a lot of low frequency sound that just can't have the attack of a cone woofer. So how deep it goes is not an issue with magnapans. I mean, up to a point.
Up to a point. You say they go down to about 40 hertz or so.
Yeah.
Right.
Or down to a point, actually. So, you know, we've been talking about home theater as if everybody who has a home theater has a 5.1 system. When nowadays, they're fairly likely to have a soundbar speaker. And I don't like soundbars. I have a thing about soundbars. And I think that buying a pair of powered stereo speakers from companies like Audio Engine or Emotiva or Meridian, there's many companies that make powered speakers where you can actually place them wider than a soundbar could ever be. You could place them 6 feet or 8 feet apart. So we're getting back to home theater 2.0 or 2.1. But at any price range for a soundbar, I think you can get much better sound from a pair of powered speakers. I really don't like soundbars. it's a solution, and I think depending on what your expectations are, it can work perfectly well. They do sound better than the speakers that are built into a TV.
Was the point I was going to make. Now let's talk about soundbars.
It's a low bar, pardon the pun.
It's a very low bar to set. I do know that. And let's continue to talk about that for just the minutes that we have left. But before we do, I have a third sponsor to thank for being with us in this episode, and that is, in fact, Hulu Plus. Now, Hulu Plus, many of you know about Hulu, of course. It's a website where you can go on your computer and watch a bunch of different content, but it's on your computer. So what do you do when you want to go off on your iPad or into your home theater that we've been talking about, on your phone even as you're commuting? Where do you go for the content then? Well, you go to HuluPlus.com because that is where you can get all of the content that you want, really, thousands of movies and TV shows and even original content, all for one low monthly subscription fee, which is the model I tend to prefer, to tell you the truth. $7.99 a month gets you as much as you can possibly consume. As they say at Hulu Plus, sometimes you can binge. And believe me, I have. you know, it's just a great way to get access to tons of content. Your favorite TV shows like Jimmy Kimmel Live, Shark Tank, Family Guy, Saturday Night Live. I typically tend to catch up on Saturday Night Live there on Hulu Plus. And you can watch every episode of shows like Lost, Doctor Who, Community, and Star Trek. Certainly one of the shows that I tend to binge on, but that's just me. And as I said earlier, they also provide exclusive content. They've created exclusive content, Hulu originals like The Wrong Man's and Behind the Mask, which is about those sporting event mascots. You know, who's the person that's wearing that suit on the field? This show is quite interesting because it gives you an inside look at those people who perform that really important job, I think, at sporting events. You also have a great access to a great collection of ad-free movies and kids content, all for only $7.99 a month, when you can catch up on current shows, binge on old favorites, or catch a great movie. Stream as many shows as you want, wherever you want, on any device that'll do it. Right now, you can try Hulu Plus free for 2 weeks when you go to HuluPlus.com/HTG. Now, that's a special offer for our listeners, so I want to make sure you use that URL, HuluPlus.com/HTG, so you get that extended free trial, and they know we sent you, which we really would appreciate. And we appreciate Hulu Plus for their support of TWiT and Home Theater Geeks, and we do hope that you will enjoy watching instantly on Hulu Plus. So we were talking about soundbars. We started talking about soundbars, and clearly you don't particularly like them.
Not a fan.
Have you heard the Pioneer? I'd say of all the soundbars I've heard, the Pioneer designed by Andrew Jones is pretty good.
I think it's very, very good.
As a soundbar. I mean, you're mm-hmm. right. Soundbar doesn't give you the wide stereo spread. But sometimes it might not be practical to put separate speakers in the room. Mm-hmm. So I find them to be of value when it comes to replacing the TV sound, which, as we said, was a very low bar to overcome. But some sound bars really can get quite a bit better than that. Not as good as true speakers, but if you don't have room for them or you can't really put them in your bedroom or something like that.
Yeah, oh, I understand. You know,
the other cool thing about the Pioneer, I just want to make sure I mention, is that they don't do any of this virtual surround business.
Right.
They just do two channels. They don't even have a center channel in that soundbar, just right and left, and a subwoofer.
Right. It's very well done. Andrew Jones is a hugely talented guy. Yeah. And I don't think anybody sets out to make a bad speaker, really, you know, at least from a credible company. And I interviewed Andrew Jones actually a number of times.
Mm-hmm. And he's been on this show a couple times.
Yeah, he's a great guy. And I said to him, so what makes you so special, basically? Like, how do you do this when no one else can, you know, or very few people can? Yeah. And he said that, you know, when he designed the Pioneer speakers, not before the soundbar, the SPBS-22 and the 52, those are the bookshelf and the floor standards. And I said, what does that mean? You know, when you say design a speaker, what is designing a speaker for you? And he said, well, what I do is, it took me, speaking in his voice, 6 months to design those speakers. And I said, what does that entail? He said, well, I would sit at a computer, I would design a driver. They would make one prototype, you know, tweeter and woofer, send it to me. I would get the speaker, the driver in. I would mount it. I would put sound through it. I would measure it. I'd, you know, listen to music on it. And then I would make corrections in my design, send them that information to the people who are building the prototypes. They would build another prototype. They'd send me the prototype. I would measure it again, and I would keep doing that until basically I couldn't do it anymore because the time was up. But that time was 6 months. And he said, and other people just don't seem to want to or afford to invest that much time into making something that's really exceptional. And that's what he did. And that's how he did the soundbar. Was there was lots of trial and error from a guy who's famous for building $80,000 TAD speakers, the company that's owned by Pioneer. So he's used to working without limits. And actually, he enjoyed working within the constraints of making something great that was very affordable by real people. That's not too many people that work that way in the audio industry, you know.
That's correct. So, and he really did a great job, I think, as well. I'm sure you will agree. I mean, for the money, absolutely. Those speakers are amazing.
Yeah. And the soundbar is amazing.
And the soundbar is amazing for what it is. Yeah, absolutely.
A few that I would recommend for people who absolutely need one. Although I did say to Andrew Jones, I said, but if you had a choice or someone asked you, well, what sounds better, the soundbar or a pair of the BS-22 speakers and the subwoofer and a stereo receiver? And he said, well, the speakers are going to sound better. It's a less compromised way of making sound.
Mm-hmm.
It just is, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, in the couple minutes we have left, I wanted to make sure that everybody listening to this podcast was hipped to your article that you wrote about a year and a half ago now on your Audiophiliac blog called The Top 10 Reasons Why Music is Compressed. I want to come full circle here. We were talking about compression, dynamic range compression, and how music is so terribly compressed in so many cases. And all you have to do, what I did, was just Google top 10 reasons music is compressed, and this will be the first thing that pops up.
It got a big reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
and you know what's funny? Some people thought I was saying that these reasons were good. I'm not saying that those are the reasons, you know, that it's a good thing that's music compressed. I'm explaining why music is compressed. And I think that the number one reason that, you know, that I put on that list was that even audiophiles who complain the most about compression misunderstand what it is. That is, when they hear a recording that is less compressed or uncompressed, many times they will complain that it's too low in the overall volume level. Mm-hmm. And I would explain to them that's because there were quiet parts and then there were really loud parts. And since it's not loud all the time, the average level will be very quiet compared to most other recordings you own. So when you take out the compressed recording and pop in the uncompressed one, you're going to have to turn up the volume level to get the quieter parts to be as loud as the average parts of the other record. So here's what I'm going to do, Scott. I'm working on a test disc for Chesky Records, and I am going to have a singer, a singer do a little a cappella piece where she whispers very quietly, and then she'll sing a little louder and a little louder, and then she's going to just scream her guts out. So we're going to have that track uncompressed. And then we're going to do what everybody else does so that the whisper quiet stuff is just as loud as the scream. It's an old Elvis Costello song called From a Whisper to a Scream. It's not going to be that song, but I'm just saying. Right. So I want people to make sure that they get it. Because you see, most of the time, if you give people the choice, which is why the top 10 reasons exist, if you give people the choice, they'll usually prefer the compressed one because it's loud.
Right. That's your number one point here.
Yeah,
audiophiles like to complain about compressed music, but they actually prefer it.
Right. And I'm also going to do a test on this disc where I'm going to have a drummer play with dynamics, as they say, where he plays very, very quietly and then gets louder and louder and then just totally wails on it. And I'm going to have that track uncompressed. And then I'm going to have it so that the quietest parts are as loud as the loud parts. Just to make sure we all understand what that means.
This is a brilliant idea.
Oh, thank
you. I applaud you for it. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I can't wait to hear it.
You know, there's a musician joke where the producer says to the drummer, you know, hey, Jim, could you play with dynamics? And the drummer says, I'm playing as loud as I can. I guess that's sort of an inside joke.
It's a good musician's joke. Yeah, no, that's good.
Right. So there you go. And I probably have one or two others. But if anybody – oh, people can follow me, by the way, speaking of following.
Yes.
They can follow me on Twitter.
and a good place to follow.
I put up stuff constantly on there, and it's at Audiophiliac Man. Audio, Philiac. Audiophiliac Man at Twitter.
It's on Twitter. That's your handle.
That's my handle.
Go look for Steve Guttenberg there on Twitter, audiophiliacman.com. And also check out his blog, by all means, news.cnet.com/audiophiliac. Steve, thanks so much for being on the show.
There's three or four of those a week on CNET.
Three or four a week? Holy smokes.
Yeah.
You're a writing machine.
I am. Barely had time to come here today. I'm so busy.
Well, I thank you so much for being here again.
Oh, this is fun.
And I'm glad you think so. And we'll do it again sometime.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You can find me, of course, at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. You can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott or at avsforum. Either one will work. And you can find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Mark Seaton, an exceptional speaker designer. We've been talking about speaker design today, and we will be talking about it again next week with Mark Seaton, who is a strong advocate in the DIY community. So if you've ever thought about building your own speakers, you'll want to tune in for that episode because it's going to be great. Mark's a very knowledgeable guy, very well respected on AVS and many other places. So I'm looking forward to speaking with him very much. And I do hope you will join me. Until then, geek out.